Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Here today with Hugh Atchison. I'm Michael Harlan Turkel, your host. Hugh's hailing from Athens, Georgia. Come up to New York for this great new cookbook, New Turn in the South. Lucky enough to have a copy in front of me, and I read it from cover to cover, and like literally read it from cover to cover. There's so much. Not just amazing recipes, but the pace, the kind of canter of the whole thing is just this slow and steady speed that just makes you want to sit down and sip some sweet tea.
Yeah, it was very much meant to be a reflection of the, you know, we all live in communities, and it's a reflection of mine.
Yeah.
Mine is Athens, Georgia, and it's a certain cadence to the life there in canter, you're right.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is.
But and so. Athens, Georgia wasn't your community growing up. You're a Canadian.
Yeah. I'm a Canuck. So I'm from Ottawa, but I grew up in Ottawa and then went to university for a little stint in Montreal and lived in Montreal for a while. But you know, when I was between 10 and 14-ish, I lived in the States. So I lived in Atlanta and Clemson, South Carolina. So got a taste of what Southern living was. And eventually my wife is from the South. So we moved down there.
Yeah.
And you know, it was just always, it's such an amazingly rich place in so many ways. And, you know, my father-in-law is a very Southern academic, and watching the sort of pace at which he lives his life and then thinking about Southern academics and writers
yeah.
and cooks, and it's just a different world from anywhere else in the United States.
Did he have shoulder and elbow pads?
Yes. Yeah, he had the full-on, like, English professor yeah. uniform, and that's what he did at Clemson University. So, you know, it's fun to look at the South, and then culinarily looks at the South as this amazing tome of interest and knowledge. And it's not always pretty to look at Southern history and Southern food history because it's ripped apart by racial tension and
yeah.
wars and everything. But that is the only identifiable culinary history in the States. I mean, we can look at other places and say, well, there's a New England crab boil and there's chowder. And then, you know, there's smoked salmon and, you know, California cuisine. But those are also nascent.
Yeah.
The South has this history, and it's just there, and it's so in-depth. So, you know, my taking of it and my understanding of it is going to be completely different from most people's because I'm this interloper, never influenced by my mother's collard greens, never influenced by, you know, that pressure.
Yeah.
So I can go about it with, like, a little bit of French technique and my background in food and be like, okay, I think this is what they mean by chicken and dumplings.
Yeah. Well, I mean, did you have a Canadian background in food? Do you remember some of the, you know, inherent dishes that you ate growing up?
I mean, I can remember more of this. No, growing up, I mean, I think I ate fish sticks and canned yellow beans coming from a divorced household
yeah.
raised by my father. My mother was a pretty good cook, but we didn't usually live with her. So, when I was young and cooking in Canada, I mean, it was very game-oriented. But that was also a culture that was thoroughly invested in artisanal, sustainable, and local before those were co-optable cool terms.
Yeah.
You know, between the Gatineau Mountains next to Ottawa and the Laurentian Mountains going into Quebec City, there's an amazing bastion of farmers and dairies. And, you know, when I worked in a restaurant in Canada, you know, the venison came in the back door, and that guy also grew shiitakes. And then the spinach would be delivered by a guy named Jean-Pierre, and
yeah.
then his wife, Hélène, would bring goat cheeses. And that was just the way of the world. And, you know, luckily, we're hearkening back to that in the South. You guys are doing an amazing job in Brooklyn of sort of the idea of the local sphere. I shy away from local vor.
Yeah.
All those terms are just so greenwashed and co-opted now that, you know, we're just trying to make sure that, you know, before all of that became co-optable, that's kind of what we were doing. That's how I was raised in food.
Yeah.
So that's a very Canadian thing. There's an intrinsic interest in food up there that's always been the case. Like, you go shopping in Montreal when I was at university, you know, we'd grab four shopping bags and I would go to this place called Vieille Europe for coffee and smoked bacon. And then I would go across the street to Saint-Laurent Boulangerie and buy rye bread. Then I go around the corner to Saint-Viateur Bagel.
Mm-hmm.
And I go down the street and buy cheeses. And I go to the meat guy and buy meats. And I go to, you know, the produce guy. And it was just how we shopped.
Well, I mean, being I wouldn't call it a second-class European city, but rather than having to go to a supermarket and get everything from one giant box, you see your purveyors, you befriend those people.
Right.
So, I mean, that goes to farms and fields alike.
And it does. I think that teaches you a lot about where food comes from and how you create food and create dishes and how you sustain yourself and how you save money. And it's somewhat what I'm preaching these days is this whole idea of taking a bit of an inconvenient route in life. You know, we just buy this stuff and consume all this stuff that's too easy.
Yeah.
It's like everything is like, you were talking about making bread and stuff like that. It's like, everything's so easy now that we don't have to think about making bread in middle America and making our own bacon.
Yeah.
I mean, hell, they have pre-cooked bacon at the store now. It's like, really? How hard was cooking bacon?
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about this concept of crumbled feta?
Well, it's
as opposed to crumbling it goddamn self?
Deli slices at that point. I mean, I know not everybody has a...
A slicer, but still, you know, it's like, yeah, whatever happened to the deli?
Yeah.
You know? That's just a funny world.
Did you realize this when you were between the ages of 10 to 14 and you moved down to the South, that this kind of culture was surrounding you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there was a lot of those Canadianisms in the places that I could shop in Canada, in the Byward Market in Ottawa and places like that, that were, when I went to a lot when I was young, that were missed in the South. But the South still had its beauty then. Much marred by the sort of, you know, 50s to 1980s of this age of the burgeoning age of convenience and packaged foods and things like that. But there was still, you know, the step grandmother coming over and making fried okra from scratch and making grits in the morning, and my father or my stepfather making bread all the time. So were there, and, you know, cooking of collards and fried chicken, and then my mother trying to embark on different recipes and she had no idea. So, you know, there was that Southern, unwavering sort of Southernism to food that refused to become convenience items. But, you know, I think what I'm trying to explain in the book is that Southern food doesn't stop being defined. It needs to continue to be defined.
Yeah.
You know, somebody like Paula Deen's like, you know, we need to make sure our smothered pork chop is this smothered pork chop recipe. And
yeah,
then her pants fall down and she does. But, you know, what I want to prove is that we can lighten Southern food and make it really cool and make it, but still have that homage and that nod to the original structure of Southern food, which is so pretty.
Yeah.
But the South's ever changing too. I mean, it's becoming more worldly. We're seeing other cultures influence it all the time. There's a huge Vietnamese population around the Gulf. There's great Asian populations around Atlanta that are really influencing the food there. So, you know, in a forum the other day, I was interviewing Paula Deen, and I brought up the idea of making rice grits or broken kernels of long grain rice. And they were used to be kept by the Gullah community in the Lowcountry. And the whole rice in the rice economy would have been exported to Europe. But they make a porridge, kind of like a congee, almost.
Yeah.
And so we take rice grits and we finish them with pureed kimchi that we make at one of the restaurants and a little bit of cream. And it's awesome. And Paula looked at me in this, like, just like I was an alien from another planet. But I think it's important that we continue the discussion about Southern food and what can be great in Southern food and evolve it, because I think it's important to make sure it's always inclusive. Because the Southern food that people think is like just like gut-stopping, artery-clogging food of yore it doesn't have to be that way. But there's great flavor profiles in all that food.
Yeah.
We just have to figure out how to make it edible again.
Yeah. I mean, what's really cool about the book is I think you first flip through and you see those staples. You see the word smothered. You see
right.
cane vinegar. You see ham hocks. You see collards. And you know it is a Southern cookbook. But then you see these small little twists, either through technique or just you see your personality shining
right.
through.
And, yeah.
You know, Southern can be redefined.
It can be. And I mean, that was the biggest thing about the book is how do I get across my really strange personality into a book? And well, it came through in doodles and, you know, me just writing off the cuff statements and hopefully how to on the actual instructions of a cookbook. I think that's where a lot of cookbooks go wrong, because halfway through the how-to you're like, what the hell is this person talking about? Yeah. I mean, I'm this is what I've done for 25 years and have the recipes out there. I'm like, where what do they mean?
Yeah.
So we try to be really clear about that, and but also just make it food that people want to cook at home and get into the idea of you know, cooking Southern food.
Yeah. What I also found kind of interesting is we mentioned those, you know, certain staples. There are a lot of pantry items too, kind of like, you know, how to make cornbread or how to make green tomatoes. But
right.
then there's that little twist again, you know, green tomatoes with the pickled shrimp.
Right.
That there are, you know, an homage to grits, you know, by using Anson Mills.
Right.
But then using them in a ton of awesome recipes in right. awesome ways. So I think part of Southern cooking is not only being honest to the ingredient and the legacy of these things, but realizing who you have around you, like Anson Mills, and
right.
supporting them just as they supported that community for years.
Yeah, which is, it was in a funny way, again, I think the South was one of the pioneer sort of food traditions that knew the names of all their farmers and knew where stuff came from. And that was how people ate that back then. And I think it's just becoming more and more so now. But that's pretty much countrywide. I mean, you know, we've opened that can of worms, and I'm glad we have, that, you know, food, it helps to understand that food doesn't have to go through gazillion different middlemen before it hits your plate.
Yeah.
So to know that Charlotte and Wes, who are having brunch at the bar, Empire State South on Saturday, delivered and raised all the pork for the restaurant all week long, and that they're also the people that go to their neighbor and get me sorghum and broker this cheese and buy me sheep's milk. You know, it's just like, that's the beautiful small world we live in down there now.
Yeah. And how many restaurants do you have right now?
Three. 5 and 10 in the National in Athens, and then Empire State South in Atlanta.
How many farms do you think you have supplying those three restaurants?
About 35.
Yeah. And I'm sure you have everyone's phone number in.
Yeah, for different reasons. Yeah. I mean, some of them, you know, some of them are farm/foragers, and you know, Hope Springs Farm just brings me eggs for Athens, and Johnson Dairy brings me dairy from South Georgia, and you know, so it's a smattering of different people doing different things. Sometimes we have to reach a little bit further. You know, there's no great country ham within, you know, 120 miles, but as long as we get into Madisonville, Tennessee, and where Alan Benton is, and Colonel Newsom, and all that stuff is happening up there. And then we go as far north as Virginia for some stuff with lamb. But, you know, like Shamrock is doing at Husk, you know, we believe that the South is the South, and as long as we buy from there, we're doing right by what we believe in.
Yeah. So. But, you know, I've always loved about this concept of what Southern cuisine is in my mind is particular.
Right.
And if you don't have what you want there, you're going to go that little further, you know, that extra mile to be able to find it. And that's why you found country ham that isn't necessarily within this circumference.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's I'm not one to want to take the big jump towards, you know, it has to be a 60-mile radius and all this. I don't think we're ready for that yet. First and foremost, I cook for a community. So the community is rich and poor, and I want to appeal to all those people. I want everybody to have an excuse at least once a year to come to the restaurant. So if I was to isolate and say, well, everything's going to come from my immediate area, it'd probably be more expensive food. And, you know, I don't want to do that. So I just want to get people slowly eating better and figuring things out more about Southern food. So it's a good trek right now.
Yeah. So what are your hottest dishes? I mean, what are the things that people crave? Is it the fried chicken, or is it this riff on what is fried chicken?
I'd say the riff on fried chicken is probably more popular. But, you know, a lot of the food in the book is more food that we do. There's food definitely that's done at 5 and 10 a lot. But then a lot of the food is more food that is meant for home. And fried chicken and stuff is generally stuff we do at home. We do variations of it once in a while at the restaurant. But what's out at the restaurant, I mean, you know, over time, Frogmore stew and things like that, which is a variation of a low country boil.
Yeah, can you tell me more about what Frogmore stew is? Because you also get into the etymology of these dishes,
yeah,
of these processes.
So Frogmore stew was, Frogmore was a town that was pretty much overrun by Hilton Head, South Carolina, the development of, you know, Vacation Land USA. Mm-hmm. Tennis courts abound. So as that happened, the old town of Frogmore, which there still is a little airport there, there was Frogmore stew, which was one of the ubiquitous low country boils. So it was, you know, corn on the cob, an andouille sausage, and local shrimp right there, which would be Port Royal, you know, potatoes, new potatoes, and leeks, and or leeks would be mine, but sweet onions and fennel would be mine too, and Old Bay. So you stick it all in a pot, you pull out solids and eat them, and you jettison the liquid. Well, I was like, I mean, again, I was raised in French kitchens. I was like, why on earth would you throw away all that liquid?
Yeah.
You know, so we do it with less liquid. We do it with a really refined fish broth or clam juice and fresh tomato juice and all the beautiful aromatics in there. And we wanted to turn it on its head and kind of make more like a bouillabaisse.
Yeah.
So, and we succeeded really well, and it won a lot of sort of, you know, attention and whatnot. But it's a really simple recipe, and it's like, that's what we do. It's just simple food.
But it's funny hearing you say that, because with the French background, obviously, it is about being thrifty at some points, too.
Right.
You're reusing. But Southern cuisine, pot liquor, I mean.
Right, yeah.
It's like gold. And to waste a liquid like that.
I know. I've never really understood it.
Yeah, and that's back to the boils. Particular. You know, there is a recipe. Yeah. You follow that recipe, and you don't use anything from that recipe for another recipe.
Yeah.
And that's what kitchens have started changing in the South.
I mean, you're using everything. It's like nose to tail is one thing, but it's like now we're into like top leaf to bottom root.
Yeah.
And using everything in between.
In the soil, in the air.
Yeah,
in the rain.
Exactly. Everything around it. So, but it's fun to talk about, you know, how we're using turnips these days. If we do, you know, buttered turnip greens with the tops, then we take the stems and we cut them really fine and do pickled turnip stem. And then we take the turnips and we do it, you know, the top half of it for a soup and the bottom half of it for, you know, butter roasted or brown butter turnips or whatever. So it's like, and then now with things, flowers going to bolt and things like that, utilizing before when flowers and plants and stuff went to bolt, we'd basically, you know, compost them through. But now we're clipping and serving all the flowers as edible flowers and salads and things like that. So it's like we're all changing the way we look at food.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not left out in the cold in the South in that regard. It's like carrot top salad now. It's great. You know, it's fun. But, you know, we wouldn't have thought about it five years ago.
Right, yeah, it's not so much like, no, you don't eat that part. It's like, now, how can we eat
that
part?
How can we do that?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like we had a carrot dessert on for a while that had candied carrot tops on it. It's like, that's cool.
Yeah.
That works. So.
Excellent. Yeah. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back and find out why this Canadian found home in Athens, Georgia. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back.
The program was sponsored by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Summertime is not the only time when barbecue is welcome. At S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, Sam Edwards has been working his magic on ribs, briskets, pit-cooked pulled pork, and much, much more. Add a few of their sides and the party is complete. Entertaining has never been so easy. To order, go to virginiatraditions.com.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Hugh Atchison. I don't know. I've been worried for the past couple days trying to say that name.
I responded that guy.
Yeah.
So it's pretty easy.
Yeah. So, I mean, and you're pretty recognizable now, having been on Top Chef, right?
Yes.
Judging on the upcoming Top Chef.
Yeah, I was on Top Chef Masters for a season and was known as the sort of jackass of the show. And then,
how so?
I don't know. I was the only one willing to have fun.
Yeah.
That's the way I look at it.
I think that's the point of those things.
I split America right down the middle on whether they like my one eyebrow or hate it. I don't really care. And now, yeah, so I'm a judge on the season 9 of Top Chef. So, you know, it's a fun diversion for what I do every day to get away and film that stuff and hang out with people. And it's a great group of people that produce that show.
Yeah.
It's a huge team, and they're fun. They're pros. And, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's a good break, and it fills restaurant seats. You know, in bigger cities, not in Athens. Athens is a small town.
Yeah.
It's going to fill its own seats. It'll do fine. But Atlanta, you know, you can always use a push in a big city and right glitzy restaurant in the middle of the city. So, who knows?
So, Athens, always going to fill seats. There's community around there.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find yourself moving there?
You know, I met Mary, my wife, when I was very young, and we weren't married at the time, and we were just friends, and but stayed in touch. Then in my early 20s, she came up to visit and ended up moving up to Canada, and she eventually, when we were about 25, we got married. And decided she would do graduate work down in Athens at the University of Georgia in art history. So she was going to do her master's. And I was, at that point in time, had worked in a number of really, really great restaurants in Canada. But I was young, and I was a complete idiot and whatever.
Where did you work in Canada?
I worked at a place called Café Henri Berger, which is a very French place in Hull, Quebec, that was there for 90-some-odd years and then closed down recently. It was a great old, very old school. You know, they serving horse and partridge and pheasant.
Yeah.
And, I mean, really old school French place. So big ambassadors hang out. And kind of, but it was fun. It was great. You know, Philippe, the maitre d', and all, you know, all these people taught me so much about food. You know,
well, you knew not to pronounce it Henri Berger.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, that didn't get good accolades. When you're making in a restaurant environment where, you know, your prep list contains making two consommés at age 22 and, you know, mise en place for every vegetable set in the whole restaurant and, you know, your soups and then prepping for garde-manger and stuff like that. It's just you learn how to structure yourself. You learn a lot about the cores of food and you learn a lot about just the cores of French cooking. So, you know, when everybody's like, yeah, you're self-taught. No, I was taught in great French kitchens in that time. So, and then worked at a place called Maple on Cafe with my friend Rob McDonald, who was a young chef in Canada, who was really, really talented chef, eventually quit chefdom and was last seen in one of my dad's graduate level economics classes. So we moved down to Athens and I worked at a restaurant there for 2 years, which was fine. It wasn't my own restaurant. I was working for somebody else. And the restaurant was needed improvement in its food, but it was fun and it was a very busy restaurant. I mean, doing, you know, 300 covers at night, but a small restaurant, it was 100 seats and learned a lot. Went out to San Francisco for 2 years after that, learned a ton about food working at Mecca and then opening up Gary Danko, which was a great fine dining place where I wasn't there for very long, but it was important to work there for a little while. In a lot of ways, I learned what I didn't want to do, which was be a militant soldier in a fine dining, hellhole.
Mm-hmm.
Love you, Gary.
I'm sure he's listening right now.
Too. I'm sure he is too. He's got enough.
He's gonna, actually, we have a call. That's Gary Danko.
So, you know, I think that, you learn a lot. And, so finally San Francisco's awesome city. It's great. It is not great if you make, you know, a chef de cuisine salary in, you know, $30,000, $32,000 a year in because what San Francisco is not great at is the middle. there's very, very poor and there's very rich and there's not much in the middle of San Francisco. There's not much equity. So, and it's hard to live in, outer Berkeley or, and commute in all the time. So even my commute within the city was really, really long. And we lived in the Lower Haight, and going up to Danco would take me an hour.
Yeah.
On bus. Well, it was fine.
Yeah, except bus on the
Fine if you're working a 9-hour shift. But if you're working a 16-hour shift, add an hour on each end for transport, and then you're like, wait a minute, I just got home, and I have to be at work in 4.5 hours. <It's> like, this is untenable.
Yeah.
So, yeah, eventually I got a call back from the woman who owned the restaurant that I worked in Athens. She was like, well, I've got this lead on this restaurant space. I'm thinking about opening something. Would you like to come be a partner there? And I was like, you know what? Sure.
Yeah.
So at the age of 27, I guess, I opened 5 and 10. And, you know, it was a restaurant. It was just, you know, it was open for not very much money, really small budget. It was kind of like I couldn't afford managers, so I was going to be... Everything was going to be kitchen-centric. Everything was going to emanate from there. I was going to have to be the accountant and the bookkeeper and the plumber and the electrician and much what I see around here.
Yeah.
Something breaks, I fix it and figure out how. But half of it was figuring out how. That was every day. Doing an ambitious menu for Athens, Georgia with a lot of food that they hadn't really seen before. So sweetbreads were sold as... really good chicken McNuggets. I don't know. Yeah. You should try Skate Wing.
Yeah. Sometimes you just talk about the exteriors, like that sweetbread is fried. So
it's right. Eaten fried. Yeah. It's crispy. Yeah,
declassified.
You like crispy? Yeah. You'll like this crispy.
Yeah.
So, Skate Wing was, you'd have people be like, we throw this back in the South.
Yeah.
It's like,
But both those recipes are in the book and make sense in the context of it too.
Yeah. And they do. And it's, but in a lot of essence, they're so Southern too, those recipes. And they're so purist and simple and straightforward. And that's what we reveled in. So, in those early years, I was the guy trying to find, as many local purveyors as I could to bring me anything. And it worked. I mean, we got a lot of stuff. We still had to lean on some big broadline distributors for our guts and stuff like that. But still to this day, all the food stuff comes from locals. And then, but we still have to buy some other stuff shipped in and whatnot. So it's not, it was at a time where it was more difficult than it is to do it now.
Yeah. So, but let's talk about things that are there, like hominy.
Yeah.
Can you explain what hominy is, what the process of making hominy is as well?
Mm-hmm. It's corn soaked in a lye solution or a lime. You can do it with culinary lime, like pickling lime. Basically, it's a nixtamalization process of corn.
Yeah.
So the most common ground nixtamalized corn is going to be masa. White grits are nixtamalized grits. But the hominy is whole kernel nixtamalized corn. So often you'd find it in a can. You'd open it up. Combine it with another can, and you'd have poor man's pozole.
Yeah.
but, you can find beautiful dried corn and make it into wonderful hominy by just nixtamalizing it yourself.
So are you actually doing that solution at the restaurant?
Yeah, we buy dried corn from, dried hominy corn from Glenn Roberts and Anson Mills, who's, Glenn's one of these guys who you call and an hour later after he's told you about the origin of every grain that he knows of, you're finally free. It's funny that farmers and organic farmers and people who are seed savers and the wonderful people in my life, one of the things is they don't talk to humans that much. They talk to plants a lot. Yeah.
And they think they have to get everything out the first time too. So you have to sit through that 8-hour opus lecture.
Exactly. Yeah. We use hominy a lot at the restaurant. So, you can puree hominy into a really interesting soup. And though I still want to make that interesting soup better. but we use a lot of hominy as a simple hominy stew underneath things. But you can buy a canned hominy and it's fine if you don't want to go through the process. It's just not as good.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
In all those Southernisms of the cadence of life and how you talk to your purveyors and you know, called Alan, my favorite story about Alan Benton 10 years ago. I called Alan Benton and I said, I've heard of your hams and I want to order some of your hams. And, well, that's great. Who were you again? Hugh Atchison. Oh, I've heard of you. Okay. So a week goes by. I get the hams and 10 days go by and I call back up there for another order. And Alan, somebody else answers the phone. And I say, can I speak to Alan? And they say, yeah, one moment. Alan comes on the phone and goes, hello, who is this? I was like, it's Hugh Atchison. There's a long pause. And Alan finally says, gets on the phone and says, you don't need to tell me your last name. I know who you are. Yeah. We met last week.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's so Southern. It's just like you're entered into the fold of this conversation of food in the South. We're dealing with each other again. Let's move on. Make this more efficient.
Yeah.
So that's great. But there's so many Southern foodstuffs that we don't see that much up here, but they're starting to come up to Brooklyn and New York and the boroughs and become more popular in Chicago and places like that. So, you know, we use a lot of sorghum.
Mm-hmm.
We use a lot of muscadines and scuppernongs.
Yeah. What are muscadine and scuppernongs?
They're grape varietals, very thick-skinned native grape varietals in the South. And if you go and have scuppernong or muscadine wine, it's generally made by somebody's uncle. And it's good. Yeah. I mean, it's great. They're on the sweeter side. And, you know, they have big pits, big seeds. But, you know, you learn to swallow the seeds. You don't want to chew on them. They're really tannic. And the skins are thick, but they have this beautiful flavor to them and just kind of musty, sweet, big. But you can make jams out of them. You can do gelées out of them. You can do all sorts of stuff. We pickle muscadines and scuppernongs. We make wine with them. We make wine and then we distill it into eau de vie and, but don't tell anybody that. So
once
you know,
again, no one's listening.
Yeah, no, nobody.
Damn Gary.
Nobody's. We don't have stills. Yeah. Now where we're from.
Yeah.
So you know, they're just another. But they grow like crazy down there. Yeah. So they're just kind of everywhere, and they're beautiful flavors.
Well,
so.
Do you find it funny that you know you're sitting down there trying to live off the land that these things are now being exported as hot ingredients?
Yes, always. I mean, it's funny to see things go to that point. If I go to another New York restaurant and see boiled peanuts on the menu out of season, I mean, boiled peanuts are supposed to be green peanuts. I mean, they're green.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, people now are boiling semi-roasted peanuts or dried peanuts, which is not really what they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
But you can still do it. But you know those really dark boiled peanuts? That's from them.
Yeah.
But if you get beautiful green peanuts, they're like silky white inside when you crack them open after you boil them. They're awesome. They're totally different flavor.
Yeah.
We use one farm. You know what's really hard to find is organic peanuts.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're just all grabbed for organic peanut butter by Skippy,
yeah.
But they're really hard to find. So, but there's some great peanut farmers in Georgia, and you know, peanut farming stretches really all the way over to Texas. But I don't know what Texas got out of anything this year. It was such a drought there.
Yeah,
man, it was such a bad drought there.
Yeah, so. But you guys had a good year with most of.
We had a generally good year overall. Yeah, with things, shrimping was not the greatest year, but. When they get them, they're beautiful.
Yeah. I actually want to revisit boiled peanuts
mm-hmm.
because one of the wonderful little surprises in this book is the boiled peanut hummus.
Right.
And, I mean, where did you concept?
You know, I think it just came from what I think about a peanut. And a peanut to me is not a nut. It's a legume. And when we think of boiled peanuts, I always think about those canned fava beans from Italy. You know, they're unshelled and everything.
Yeah,
they're
just
boiled. And they're really good, though. Yeah. But they're different. They're not like the French use fava beans. The French are fastidious with them, like we are. We take the outer casing off and then peel off the inner shell.
Well, it feels like lupini beans for Italians.
Exactly. So, yeah. Yeah. So same style. So in that way of the soft legume, I always thought that it's kind of like a chickpea. And so we just started messing around and I'd seen people do like butter bean hummus and stuff like that. But the boiled peanut hummus is really good. So it's different. It's fun.
Yeah. I actually want to talk about the visual aspects of this book because
I've
heard from people you've worked with at Clarkson Potter that you came there with a proposal, a professional proposal.
Say professional. Yeah. I'd say king doodler.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it ended up being a whole bunch of doodles in the book, too. So
right.
You must impress them with those doodles. But who did you work with as far as photos and illustration and plotting out the course of this thing?
You know, we had this wonderful photographer in Rin Allen, who is really, really skilled, and she's from Athens. Her brother's a big music producer. The family's just, they're just all uber talented people. And Rin is just kind of multi-talented in so many different things. Great photographer, but great designer. She's one of these people who, you know, knits and makes all this crazy stuff, and she's just really cool. So we sat down about 3 years ago and was like, how can we create something? People don't know my name enough. Everybody's like, you're a household name. I'm like, yeah, within my household. Yeah. not much outside of that. So we wanted to get the name out there and be like, you know, let's create something that is not going to sit on somebody's desk. So we did this beautiful silkscreen folder with this 20-page full-color pictures and diagrams and recipes and a little bit about me and why the book was pertinent, and then bullet points and all this stuff. But it was full colors, really attractive. And then we took parchment paper and hand stitched, you know, the parchment paper around that so that I have to break open that. And it was just, it was one of those things that nobody could ignore on their desk. They're like in stacks of white paper. It was this like weird thing that was standing out. And we sent it to 8 publishers, and I mean, we got a lot of offers based on that.
Yeah.
And not only did we get offers, we got offers that said, we want you to continue the vision of the proposal you put forward. So what do we have to do to get to that? The doodles actually more came later. They were like, you know, there were some sketches in the book that I had done, and they were like, we really like that, and we like your handwriting. Can you do more? And I was like, sure, I guess. But, you know, we wrote the book ourselves. We drew all the stuff ourselves. There was no ghostwriter. There was no other artist involved. Habel Construction's in the book a lot for some of the chapter openers, which is a Brooklyn-based company. And Susan Habel, one of the sisters who is Habel Construction, lives in Athens now. And they're awesome, just great people. So we have this amazing array of, we have what Brooklyn has in a lot of ways, in a microcosm, in a tiny little speck of it in Athens, which is this great assortment of people who could live anywhere in this planet. They just choose to live in Athens in a community and do funky, cool work, and they need to get out of town. There's an airport an hour away, and we fly to New York or we fly to LA and do stuff. So it's good. And then the pictures, Rin just took pictures, and I just wanted her to take not overly styled photos, not overly foodie photos. I just wanted sort of happenstance. I wanted my kids to be photographed playing with food, which is what they do every day.
Yeah. And
the food to be pictured on plates that we actually eat off of, and, you know, that sort of type of thing. So I wanted that feeling to be honest and not too stylized. It's not who we are.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you read a cookbook and then you meet the author, the person behind it, sometimes there's parody, but what made, I think, this interview so easy is because I read this book and I got exactly what I expected out of it.
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Thank you for that.
Well,
thanks for projecting
easily done
you through this book, for making such a great mark on Southern cuisine.
Yep.
Can't wait to see what you do in the future.
There's a lot to be done. I don't know. I'm going to be a dental hygienist.
Yeah.
They get more rest.
Yeah. We'll have you on the dental show.
That'd be awesome.
Excellent. Hugh Atchison. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.